It's The Wonky Show. Applications are ticking up again, but are they really? Pandemic-era accessibility measures appear to be rolling back. There's a new survey on disabled students, and medical training reform is back in Parliament. It's all coming up.
How do you balance making sure that all students can engage properly in learning and keeping that learning proper and high standard? And what's the role of staff in universities, and what's the capacity to not just say to a student, okay, you don't have to take part in this aspect, you don't have to take part in that aspect, but what support do you need to be able to take part in that? How can we optimise your time here?
And welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Beach, and here to chew the fat over this week's news. As usual, we have three top draw guests. In Harrow, it's Alex Stanley, Vice President for Higher Education at the National Union of Students. Alex, your highlight of the week, please.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. My highlight of the week is that my brother received an unconditional offer to study at King's. And so I'm hoping he becomes just as obsessed with higher education and student unions as I am.
Near Buckingham, it's Danny Payne, Head of Education and Social Mobility at the Social Market Foundation. Danny, your highlight of the week, please.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you for having me. I think my highlight of the week is that I'm at that stage of writing a report where it's all kind of coming together in the home stretch. And that's always very satisfying.
And somewhere in the HEM4 corridor, no one quite knows where, it's David Kernahan. That's DK to you and me. Deputy Editor at Wonky, David, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it has to be said, late January is peak data season. We've had the UCAS end of cycle. We've had the UCAS January deadline. We've had HESA student. And there's all kind of other exciting things that are coming up as well. So it's a good day to be in data.
So yes, we start the week with demand for HE and UCAS data. DK, walk us through it, please.
So this, on the face of it, looks like really, really good news. The application rate among UK 18-year-olds is up a tiny bit, 0.1 percentage points to 40.7%. But because of the changes in demographics, there's basically a load more 18-year-olds around. That turns out to be 4.8% increase in the number of 18-year-olds that are applying to university next year. This kind of slightly flies in the face of what seems to be emerging as a dominant media narrative that young people are turning away from the idea of university study, be that for financial reasons, for graduate employment reasons, or indeed for reasons of perceived wokeness. So the question has to be, I mean, what's going on here? Are we being told everything about demand for higher education and the way that is changing?
Right. Yes. So lots to unpack here. Alex, let's pick up that thread of, you know, what's going on, because, you know, we've seen just in the last few days, you know, lots more discussion and kind of bad press for the loan system, the fee system. But this has been going on for years. But application rates are holding up. So why do you think there's a kind of disconnect between the public conversation and kind of what people are and that sort of the voting with the feet that's going on?
Well, I don't necessarily think that this means that many of the concerns raised are untrue. It just means that the majority of young people and the majority of their parents still want to see young people going to university. They still recognise the graduate premium. They still see the benefits that come with going to university. But fundamentally, a lot of the challenges that are being discussed, whether it's about the increasing burden of debt or the challenges that students are facing during their time at university, are ones that still aren't really being challenged. And so I think there's sort of two conversations there. There's the conversation about access to university in the first place. And there it's really positive to see the application rates stay relatively steady, although it hasn't necessarily caught up with pre-COVID levels, and particularly seeing some boosts among widening participation groups. But when you look at the time that students are actually having at university, you've got 65% of students working alongside full-time study, nearly 25% of those working around 30 hours a week, and 75% of students saying that the maintenance loan doesn't cover their expenses. And so the reality, once students get to university, particularly those from widening participation backgrounds, is actually really difficult. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to drop out. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to see the benefits of their time at university. But we want to make sure that students are having the best time possible and making the most of every opportunity that comes to them at university. And what we don't want is that in 10 years' time, the narrative around university gets so bad that we start to see these numbers falling when this conversation's had on The Wonky Show after the UCAS deadline then.
Yeah. I mean, Danny, do you think some of this is about the lack of alternatives?
I think that that's one of the largest drivers. I think, you know, you can publish articles all you like, you know, by journalists who also went to university saying that it's no longer worth it, or perhaps it's worth less than it was. But like you say, what are the alternatives for young people? And research that we carried out previously found that a lot of young people are pushed to university just through inertia. Partly it will be their own understandings of if they're academically able, what they want and are able to do next. There's not really another system like university that if you are able to go and be a kind of residential student, where you're able to have that broader student experience with clubs and halls and that kind of socialization. Although Alex is absolutely right that that's getting far more exclusive and harder for students to access. But something I found really interesting was, you know, around this discussion around whether university is worth it, a couple of weeks ago, one newspaper covered a research report that was claiming that many graduates would have been better off if they'd done an apprenticeship, and they were looking at data by degree apprenticeships. And I guess that's something that people might say, well, that's an alternative pathway. Of course, it's still, you know, it's very closely connected to university, you still get a degree. But it's not really a comparable pathway because there's so few of them, to the extent that some of them are more competitive than Oxbridge. So although there are concerns about the declining premium from universities, and I'd note that's across every high participation country and is quite predictable if, you know, employers will pay less for things that are common and more for things that are rare, it still is the fact that for academically able students, if they want to optimize the likelihood of them earning more later in life, that statistically is still the best pathway for them to follow, for better or worse. And a lot of that's because of the limited alternatives for them to follow.
Mm. DK, obviously a big part of this is the demographics. Can you just walk us through where we are now and what the latest kind of projections are and what that kind of means for how we think about the future demand for HE?
Okay, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I'm actually working on a big piece on at the moment. So look out for this in future iterations of Wonky. We, as I think is widely known, there is a peak of 18-year-olds round about 2030, 2031. It's different in different parts of the UK. After that, there is a long and quite slow decline on the ONS's central projection. We are looking at a return to round about 2022 numbers-ish by the time we get to 2040 or slightly after. The unknowns here, I mean, that's the ONS's central prediction. They also have a number of other predictions for scenarios in which we see a decline in immigration, which is something we are currently facing. We see another one if we're looking at a decline in average fertility rates, which does, I mean, given the cost of living and all of the other pressures on young people, including student loans for that matter, that seems to be happening as well. People are having less children, having them later in life. It could end up being quite a substantial decline. Now, obviously, we are set up at the moment for a mass participation higher education system, loads of numbers, loads of places, and indeed, arguably, the sector is over capacity as far as it can reasonably be said for the sector to have a capacity at the moment. So there is a little bit of slack in the system. Of course, the way that higher education is funded in England and in Wales, linked directly to the number of students attracted to each university each year. That would mean a decline in income, which would mean a decline in the amount of money that universities would have to spend on staff, on resources, on maintenance, on all the other things that universities need to spend money on. So there's a lot yet to be determined, but demographically, we would expect an increase this year, and we have got an increase this year. We'd also expect an increase in the next couple of years. But after that, it's pretty much anybody's guess.
I mean, sort of building on that, one of the big conversations that's happening in the sector is one around this notion of specialization and what universities can sort of do to challenge, you know, conversations about where the sector's at and about things like capacity. And I do have worries that if you look at specialization, particularly in regions where there are where there are cold spots, like the Southwest, for instance, where I studied, the sort of impact that that might have on some of these numbers, particularly for widening participation students who may be more likely to just choose to study from home to commute to university. And I think that kind of thing may have an impact if there isn't that same provision of, particularly of some courses like the arts, and that might have a negative impact on these numbers. So maybe something to look out for.
Well, I'll build on Alex's point about cold spots. I mean, I guess if we see a decline in income for universities, the worst case scenario is we have a retraction in provision. As Alex notes, that very well is likely to be in some ways regional and will probably exacerbate existing cold spots, which, I mean, my biggest concern there is around social mobility, and particularly for access for young people from the Southwest, from the North, basically people who are not in London and not in the Southeast, who already have the lowest opportunities for social mobility in this country. I think, you know, you could think whether there's a case therefore for better student number planning, for better provision planning. Right now, what we have is a quasi-market where the funding follows the student, and it's entirely up to that student to make the decision about what, where, and where they want to study. I think that's an important principle of choice and opportunity, but there might also be, you know, later on, if financial difficulties continue, let alone worsen, among a decline in the number of 18-year-olds and therefore a decline in demand, if that's coupled with continuing with quite strict international approach to international students by government, then there might be a need to think more strategically about what the size and shape of the sector is, / what it should be to best deliver for particularly students from low socioeconomic backgrounds and underserved regions.
Mm. TK, this is obviously an issue that's highly vexed in the sector. Obviously, a lot of people want to resist kind of that extra degree of planning and number control. Is there a way of doing that? And when the system is shrinking, is there a way of doing that that kind of helps smooth out some of this, the variance in regions and, you know, other ways of looking at it? Is there a way of doing that without kind of accidentally going too far and stopping people going at all?
I think there are a number of tools in the toolbox we have used historically that we could come back to on this. I think one of the key things is to smooth out some of the funding shocks that could potentially happen to a provider or to a subject area. There did used to be a thing in the old Hefke model called the tolerance band, wherein if you had a decline in the amount of your income, then that would be capped at 5% of the previous year's income. So, I mean, what you actually took in the subject area would never decline by more than 5%. And in the same way, it would never grow by 5%, but that's perhaps a different issue. That kind of smoothing, I think, would help universities to adjust to a decline in numbers. The other thing that the government seems to be starting to think about anyway is the choice and availability of particular subjects and particular bits of higher education level training that they feel like the country might need. We can already see that we have a problem in languages, that there needs to be some support to maintain language provision, even though a declining number of young people are choosing language as their main subject of study at university. And there are other aspects of, I mean, engineering on particular technologies linked to a just transition to away from fossil fuels. I think that we need to look in particular investments in subject areas to make sure we retain the capacity. At the end of the day, if you've got a system that is balanced on the aggregated choices of 18-year-olds, then there are going to be artifacts and issues with that. In a time of declining numbers, it is going to be important to manage those changes properly so we don't accidentally lose capacity in terms of teaching or research that we later discover that we actually really, really needed.
I mean, I think what DK was saying about that kind of Hefke tolerance band is really interesting, and the fact that it also applied to a capping on the increase. I mean, something that I've thought for a long time, partly my experience working in universities during COVID and subsequent years with the cost of living crisis, impact of kind of pandemic grade booms and so on, in that I think it would be sensible, even if the sector doesn't want, and you might think it's not the best course of action to have an overall student number cap because of the impact that could have on widening access, that it does seem quite sensible to say, well, there's only so much an institution can grow each year in the same way that we worry about decline, that actually there's only so, it's only so quick that they can hire staff and procure more buildings and get the resource needed to provide the same high quality education. In the same way that there should be a certain amount that they are allowed to over recruit from the previous year. And we say that that's the point at which quality starts to decline if they're admitting far more than that. And you can have quite a generous threshold on that. But the fact that there is none for home students, I think, you know, it just leads to some of these bad reputation journalistic pieces about students having to sit on the floor, not being able to get into their lectures, contributes to really quite acute accommodation shortages in very specific parts of the country, again, which then lead themselves every kind of August, September to a whole load of news articles about that as well. And you could have a situation in which perhaps an institution is allowed to go over that, but they have to justify how they've made provisions to cater for those extra students, how they've worked with their local council to plan for impacts on local services and so on. And I think that that seems broadly sensible, and it would then equally, presumably, help protect in times of decline as well, and might help smooth over what we're seeing every results day, where the high tariff institutions are really scooping up loads of students and the destabilizing effect that that has on the middle and lower tariff institutions, which then in turn has a destabilizing effect on the local further education sector as well.
Yeah, I think I should briefly add something, that a lot of the criticism the sector faces is about the idea of a declining graduate premium. Now, the graduate premium is the money, the extra money that you'd earn if you were a graduate than if you were not a graduate. We are expecting in the next few weeks a new publication of LEO data that will explicitly make the comparison between somebody who went to university and somebody with a similar background and similar qualifications on entry that did not. In some ways, this is a little bit of a red herring. In a big part of the decline in the graduate premium is linked to the increase in the amount of loans and interest that graduates need to repay. The system is quite delicately balanced on the idea that it covers as much of the cost of higher education as possible from within this graduate premium. But there is eventually going to be a point when the costs for graduates become a lot higher than the actual benefit in lifetime earnings that they might get. Now, when this happens, this will be played as a failure of universities. I mean, not least because everything that happens in universities is portrayed as a failure of universities, but it is also a failure of the design of the funding mechanisms, in that if it is too expensive for graduates, then that graduate premium and the reason for actually getting into all of that debt, it does kind of disappear at that point, and we're left with the more general arguments about graduates generally being healthier, being happier and more civically engaged. As student numbers potentially decline in the future because of demographics, this again needs to be something we keep an eye on. There is, I think, a certain carrying capacity of graduates in a modern skills-based economy that we do need to be hitting. And if we start to face problems where we're not hitting that, that's probably going to cause a real problem in terms of national productivity and competitiveness.
Right, so let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Susanna Kalatowski, Director of Policy at University Alliance. This week on Wonky, I've been blogging about why the NHS needs to treat universities as genuine partners. The NHS is developing a new 10-year workforce plan, but despite relying on UK universities to train its staff, now more than ever before, higher education is barely involved. The recent call for evidence didn't mention universities at all. Alliance universities are expanding degree apprenticeships, opening medical schools, and creating new routes into health careers. We can only scale that work and create the roles the NHS needs in the right places if we are brought into the planning process and government properly aligns health and education policy. That's why University Alliance and other healthcare education groups are calling for universities to be central to the new workforce plan. If it's going to succeed, we can't be an afterthought. Universities need to be treated as essential partners from the start.
Now, Disabled Students UK has published its annual survey. Danny, walk us through it, please.
Yeah, so today we've got this new report out drawing on responses from over 1,000 disabled students, looking overall satisfaction, access to adjustments, experiences with staff, and so on. I mean, it's a very large report, hundreds of pages. There's definitely a lot to dig into. I think this is particularly interesting timing given recently, well, given that we've seen a rise in disabled students coming into HE. We've seen that through the UCAS data. But also we've seen a lot of recent coverage about the rise across the pond too in the US, reasonable adjustments in both the US and the UK higher education sector, and what this means for student experience and academic integrity. So it's a very live discussion, and it's great to have some of the student voice input on that. I will say methodologically, it's quite difficult to make strong comparisons between their previous reports because of changes in how they've measured some of the questions, and also the sample size is fairly small and not representative. That being said, there is some good news in that overall satisfaction seems to be up. Disabled students are more likely to report experiencing supportive attitudes from staff, but critically, fewer than half agree that all of their reasonable adjustments were being consistently implemented. So there seems to be a disconnect perhaps between satisfaction and on-the-ground practical support. And many say that they go without support because the administrative burden of chasing for that support acts as a major barrier. Interestingly, we are also potentially seeing some of the pandemic access initiatives being paused or reduced. So things like lecture recording, remote attendance, and other flexible participation methods seem to be, from this survey, either being paused, so seeing no more increase in the availability, or in some cases declining, with universities saying that that's due to wanting to increase belonging, in-person attendance, and maintain academic integrity.
That implementation gap is quite striking, isn't it, Alex? So 44% saying agreed adjustments have actually been put in place. So what do we think is driving that? Is it bureaucracy, resources, or something else?
Well, it's particularly frustrating when one of the key findings of this report is that fewer students are actually receiving support plans. Because, I mean, when I was a sabbatical officer at Exeter, one of the big conversations about why you weren't seeing the on-the-ground support, why you weren't seeing the implementation of support promised to disabled students, was that the capacity just wasn't there, that staff couldn't keep up with the requests that were being put forward to them. And so to see that as one of the key findings, you know, for having worked in student unions, is something that does surprise me. But I do think it speaks to why implementing support as just part of the best practice of what we do more generally is so important. It's why you're seeing so many student unions and universities start to trial things like a universal design for learning, where the things that are coming up more commonly in things like sort of independent learning plans and those support plans are just made common practice, reduces the bureaucracy that you were talking about. And it's more of a common sense approach that I think in the long run means less work for academics and hopefully more support available to those students who are evidently being let down, even if they do overall feel some level of satisfaction.
I've been working recently on a report looking at the SEND system in compulsory education. And something I've been reflecting on is I think it's really interesting that the outward discussion in universities about support for students with disabilities and mental health conditions is very different to the conversation that's going on right now about SEND support in compulsory schooling. I think one reason might be just that it's reached kind of absolute crisis point in schools and local authorities in terms of the funding issues there. And perhaps that hasn't quite reached universities, although I'd note that we would expect that to trickle into the system at some point. If more and more pupils at a low age group are being diagnosed with SEND needs, then we would expect in a few years to see them coming into universities too. But I also reflect on a kind of a nervousness in the sector to have some of the more difficult conversations about supporting students who have disabilities and mental health conditions, and kind of what level of support is reasonable to expect universities to provide, firstly, and then secondly, how many adjustments can be made before the impact is detrimental on learning. And I noted that
there were reports of when they were talking about the decline in online access and so on, often universities were citing academic integrity, belonging, on-campus experience in that. Now, I'll preface this by saying absolutely, we need equal access for disabled students and their right to access education should be protected and is integral in that system. But I also think at some point we will probably be having some of those more difficult conversations that they are having in schools. And I note that people are having them privately. I had two really interesting conversations recently with people who work in universities. One who is a disability advisor who was saying, like, basically saying they don't think that universities are prepared for the influx and kind of send needs that we'll be having coming into the system. And that they're seeing a big increase in parents really expecting the same level of individualized support that was available through the SEND system in schools when their child goes to university, and how difficult that transition is for those students and for their families if the support isn't as individualized, if there is a greater expectation of you're technically an adult now, autonomy and independence. And another conversation I had with a lecturer who was saying that he teaches quite small groups and he's got so many pupils who have different adjustment needs that there's some types of teaching he can't do at all anymore, particularly seminars, because so many of the students in that class are excused from things like group work and public speaking that the seminar just doesn't work anymore. There's not enough students to run it. And so I think there's some really interesting and potentially difficult conversations about how do you balance making sure that all students can engage properly in learning and keeping that learning proper and high standard? And what's the role of staff in universities and what's the capacity to not just say to a student, okay, you don't have to take part in this aspect, you don't have to take part in that aspect, but what support do you need to be able to take part in that? How can we optimize your time here so you can engage in the fullest range of activities in universities with some scaffolding support in place? And I see that conversation is much more advanced in schools and I think will be becoming more relevant and more pertinent in universities as the years go on.
Fascinating. Fascinating. TK, I'm wondering why, on the face of it, it looks like a lot of the kind of pandemic era changes and adjustments that were made kind of being rolled back. What was it about that sort of meant at that time that sort of meant that things obviously became possible whereas they're not anymore?
I mean, if you think back to the pandemic restrictions and the way that we had to move to, what was called an emergency online provision at the time, a lot of what was accepted about teaching and the wider student academic experience, it was all up for grabs at that point. So there were lots of, kind of bits and pieces of the way assessments were done, the way presentations were made, the way classes happened, that actually benefited students who did not have that did not find it as easy as the traditional student to learn and to be assessed and to progress to the next level of their study. It was like a temporary, kind of liminal autonomous space in which lots of adjustments that were previously not possible became possible, and lots of things that were done as a way of just kind of, generally being able to teach, being able to assess, actually benefited disabled students disproportionately. With the term to what I guess we now have to call the old new normal and the pressure to go back to more traditional way of teaching, a lot of those inbuilt advantages have been lost and we've returned to a system. And this is something that shines through in these survey responses, where disabled students are expected to do extra emotional labor in order to make sure they get the support and the adjustments that they need to actually do the learning and to actually be assessed. There's a quote that obviously sticks with me as a person with a speech impediment, which is, stammering also makes some forms of moral assessment difficult and stressful. I know I've gotten worse grades in some areas of my course due to a perceived departmental unwillingness to change the setting of these assessments to accommodate me. The way in which that change would happen would be that student who has a speech impediment already having to make the argument in front of the rest of the class to their academic tutor that an adjustment needs to be made. It's a retreat from a system in which things were being designed that actually benefited all students, to the idea of, I guess you'd call it special measures, the idea that you have to do something slightly differently for different students. And if those students don't ask for those particular adjustments, they just basically don't get them. I suppose that the other thing I should just quickly note is that this also shows up in the National Student Survey. If you split by disability types, there's a lot of the main questions in which disabled students have a significantly worse experience than their peers who don't have a declared disability. But this is particularly noticeable in areas of course organization and course communication. A lot of the time, our disabled students are not necessarily struggling with the actual teaching or the actual assessment, but just the way it is organized, the way that they actually are able to get to access these things and to benefit from these things.
I guess there's a question there around potential uses of AI and digital, if actually for the most part, the teaching, the learning aspect is okay. Surely there must be great scope to automate some of the course organization and communication and to make that more accessible. I mean, I've seen some examples from US universities where they've created a personalized AI personal tutor for students where they can ask questions to it, and it largely draws on information already available on the university website. But I remember when I used to work in student unions, one of the biggest complaints was we can't navigate the website. There's so much information on a university website and we can never find which bits we want. And there's been some interesting initiatives across the pond. And I know that lots of UK universities as well are looking into the potential of AI to make services easier to access, easier to navigate, for information to make its way easier to the right student at the right time.
Hi, Mark. So yes, me and Debbie are in Canada this week at a really interesting event with a really interesting person sort of heading it up. Friend of the show, Alex Usher.
Hi there.
So what on earth is going on, Alex? What is happening here? What is going on in this kind of conference hotel?
Well, we were very impressed by the Festival of Higher Education, and Jan and I were there not this past year, but the year before. And we started thinking about what kind of event would make sense in a Canadian context. And, you know, Canada's been hit very hard by a loss of international students. We have very similar problems to the UK in terms of institutions with teetering finances and brittle business models, let's put it that way. And so the point of this meeting was to get, you know, there's lots of people in the system who want things to change and they are frustrated by the pace of change. We said, let's bring them all together. Let's get all the troublemakers in one room and have a really good discussion about what higher education could be like. What are the potential futures? And so that's what this is. It's, I don't know the number, 400, 450 people in Ottawa in the freezing cold. And it's a lot of fun so far.
One of the things I always say when we go to another country is, you know, the first thing you do for about half an hour is spot what they call a Twix or Raider, okay? You spot this kind of surface level stuff. But actually beneath the surface, even though many of the problems are similar, some of them are much more extreme in Canada, or not nearly as extreme in Canada. Do you know, what is your kind of sense of, you know, where the Canadian HE sector is at on this kind of range of problems, which are very common right across Europe and the West, you know? Yeah, having to drive more efficiency, lack of support from the public, culture wars, you know.
I mean, it's hard to find two countries more similar right now. Yes. I would say one of the differences is that Canada has much more of a unionized environment in universities. Plus, our union laws work quite differently than the UK. So when a university goes out, they go out. and you know, for anything up to 100 days at a time. And it's quite something. And faculty unions, rightly or wrongly, have been seen as the big impediment to change. And so people get very frustrated. You know, is this, I'm not convinced that's entirely correct. I mean, you could equally argue that university administrations have been bad at making the case for change, right?
Yeah.
In a language that faculty will understand, in a less nousified kind of language, you know, if I ever, you know, that's, and, you know, so I think the point here is let's get as many troublemakers in the room and talk about ideas about how we can galvanize people to really, for lack of a better phrase, to meet the moment.
Now, just on the theory of change for a second, our students' union readers will know mm-hmm. that you've got form in this area. So, you know, broadly, I think universities and lots of countries would work through a committee structure or go and see the relevant minister and so on. Yeah, certainly change in universities often seems to get stuck because you take it to the committee and so on. But, you know, both at our festival and definitely here, there's a really diverse group of people. There aren't lots of votes. There's just lots of discussion. Why, you know, if you think about all the things you've done throughout your career, including when you were, you know, kind of student
union here,
why is this the right thing to do? And do you think this kind of, you know, bringing people together with just things to say and ideas and so on can work inside a university as well as across a sector?
So here's another difference between Canada and the UK. And it is simply that Canadian universities are much less used to working across institutions right. than UK ones are. There's nothing, you know, I always like to talk about the Scottish Qualifications Authority and how, you know, their idea of quality improvement is about saying, let's get all the universities to talk about how do we improve orientation? How do we improve, you know, credit transfer, all those, you know, they pick a couple of
the enhancement theme right. work. Yeah, yeah.
That's completely foreign in North America, right? Those North American institutions, by and large, were born as small religious institutions, and therefore they were literally fighting over souls.
Yeah. And is that true inside large universities too, in terms of faculties and departments, do you think?
Yes, a little bit. It depends on the institute. Some are better than others.
Yeah.
But I would say the idea is that, you know, there are lots of things that you can only achieve by institutions, not, in, you know, cooperation at the level of vice rector, but just, you know, having professionals talk about
things.
Well, we've got a lot of professional development practice. Right? So we have, you know, we have meetings of provosts and they talk about provost things. And we have registrars and they talk about registrars.
And how awful it used to be each of them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But what we don't have are spaces where, you know, anybody can drop in. Think of it as sort of like a really good faculty lounge, right?
Yeah.
Where anybody can drop in and we can talk about important issues in a non-high stakes kind of environment and generate ideas together. And there's a friend of mine in the United States who says, look, no one university got into this mess on its own. Like, this is a model that we all own.
Yeah.
And no institution's going to get out of it on their own either, right? It's so important for people to think across institutions, share stories, share successes, share failures. That's the hard one to get people to talk about. And realize, okay, that collectively we can conduct more experiments.
Yeah.
Because Lord knows we got to experiment to get out of this nonsense. We can conduct a lot more experiments together than apart. And that's really what we're hoping to do. We came to the realization a while ago that, you know, we complained as like everyone else does. We don't need tables to sit around to talk this. And we realized actually that, you know, HESA, which operates a little bit the way Wonky does, we were the table. Actually, we are the table. We can convene people. Yeah. And that's what this is. And so we're still at an early stage. You know, I think Wonky, you guys have been doing events for a lot longer than we have. We aspire to do the kind of things that you do and bring together the kinds of people you do. And I think we're enough of a trusted voice in the Canadian scene that people are okay with us doing that.
Hi, it's Jim from the team here. AI hasn't just changed how students write essays. It's forced us to confront what learning actually means. As The Secret Life of Students returns for its 8th year, we're launching major new research revealing how students are really using AI, discussing what graduate ready means in 2026, and showcasing institutions already reimagining assessment for authentic learning at scale. Taking a step beyond what has felt like, for many, a moment of crisis, we're looking at it as a chance for creativity, and a chance to reimagine what higher education is actually for, to strip away assessments that measure memorization rather than meaning making, and to design learning experiences that develop capabilities no algorithm can replicate. At the event, you'll explore how AI can enhance rather than replace human learning, what that means for everyone, with a new government white paper reshaping the landscape from oracy initiatives to work-based learning at scale. The Secret Life of Students is the event you need. With institutions under pressure to demonstrate genuine learning gain, the timing couldn't be sharper. This is the essential gathering for anyone working on student experience, teaching practice, or education policy, where you'll get evidence, not platitudes, practical strategies, not theoretical debates, and a vision of higher education that's more human, not less. That's The Secret Life of Students, learning to be human in an age of AI, March 2026. Tickets are available now. Book on wonky.com/events.
Events.
Right, there's some new legislation going through Parliament all about medical training. Alex, what's going on?
Yeah, so this week the government has rather hurriedly, I think it's fair to say, brought this new legislation through Parliament, and it's called the Medical Training Prioritisation Bill. The idea is that it gives UK and Irish medical school graduates priority over any international applications for NHS Foundation and specialty training places. That the whole bill was promised as part of Labour's 10-year NHS health plan last summer, but we've seen it get quite caught up in some pretty tense negotiations with resident doctors over the conditions of that are seen in the bill. There's quite a lot of broad cross-party support for some of the more fundamental principles within the bill, but we've seen universities raising concerns to MPs and Lords, particularly surrounding a lack of provision for those who've graduated abroad but are at schools operated by or in partnership with UK universities. So a bit of a loophole there. And this would mean that students who have started programmes abroad, very likely under the impression that they'd be in a good position to apply for roles within the NHS, may well end up pretty disappointed. And the sort of background context to a lot of this is the government's NHS workforce plan. When Wes Streeting was the shadow health secretary, he pledged that Labour would double medical school places, but has since started to use slightly more cautious language in light of fears of an oversupply of medical graduates and shortages of training places that make this feel slightly less viable in the government's eyes.
We've got a clip of Wes Streeting introducing this in Parliament.
UK graduates used to compete among themselves for foundation and specialty roles. Now they are competing against the world because of the visa and immigration changes made by the Conservative government post-Brexit. It is a situation compounded by the previous administration's total lack of workforce planning, which saw more students going to medical school without increasing the number of specialty training places. That is why we see the training bottlenecks that resident doctors face today.
This workforce planning issue seems to be really significant, doesn't it, Danny? Because the government came in promising to double medical school places, but there's this caution about oversupply now of graduates and the shortages in training places. So what's your read on whether this is going to kind of address all of that?
Well, I guess for me, there's two main aims of something like this. One is thinking about kind of value for money for government. So the state invests a large amount, hundreds of thousands of pounds, to educate a student through medical school. At the same time, waiting lists are still too long. We've got shortages of different types of NHS roles in different parts of the country, and particularly in poor areas. So it makes sense that government would want to get their kind of value for money back from those that they're training, and that would in turn be good for people who want to access the NHS. And then the second bit, which you might think was perhaps a bigger pusher, is relationships with the union and staff satisfaction, and this being used as kind of a gift or a bargaining tool in those difficult conversations that they'll be having. I think that it doesn't guarantee either of those. So this to prioritise UK graduates doesn't guarantee that they'll be getting value for money back from that. I think the oversupply of graduates is a valid concern, and I think it's interesting that it's kind of one of the few parts of the higher education system where we do see a higher degree of planning and thinking about what happens to the graduates after they graduate. I think, you know, if the alternative, if you put loads more students through the system and they came out the other end many years later and the jobs weren't there for them, that has its own political consequences for both government and for the reputation of universities as well. And it has quite big consequences, I think, for the social contract and how those graduates will feel. And I think that some of that's coming through the general discussion about returns to university that we mentioned earlier as well. And I guess there's also a point that just prioritising UK applicants doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be getting the roles that they want. I think the Nuffield Foundation was noting that actually a lot of the kind of areas where there's really high competition for roles, it's not necessarily that across the system there's not enough roles, but there's particular competitions for certain specialties, training areas, and particular locations. Like, how do you get, say, a student who's just graduated from a top London medical school to think, I'd really like to go and be a GP in this poor rural town, you know, 4 hours away from all of my friends and family for the good of my country and because that's where the job is. You know, that's the really difficult thing, is how do you get kind of consistency across specialties and across regions.
DK, there's this issue being raised now about medical schools and the working partnership overseas.
Yeah. So a number of medical schools that are based in the UK, they also have overseas campuses where students are taught to the same standards, often by the same people using the same resources, and have similar expectation of as a career as a UK doctor. The bill as currently drafted would not actually include these students in the priority groups. So there's been a number of questions about that. This often it can be UK nationals who are living overseas. Often it can be people who are training with the express interest of becoming a doctor in the UK. Whereas it's not actually excluding these people from these training places, it is an issue of prioritization. It still feels unfair to these students who might be doing their medical undergrad with the expectation of progressing to an NHS training place and now realize that they would only get one after all of the students who actually studied in the UK have been allocated a place. Now this all plays into a wider issue, is that it takes a long time and it is very, very expensive to train a doctor. So in quite a lot of cases in NHS planning, there's been some serious looking at, I mean, what are the tasks that actually need to be done by doctors? And I mean, what are those that can be done by other medical professionals that perhaps have been trained at a lesser expense and slightly more quickly, which means that we get a more immediate bump in capacity. All of these additional doctors that are starting now, they're not actually going to qualify as doctors and be useful to the NHS until the next parliament, at least. And the idea that the majority of the benefit is going to be coming from doctors in training, dealing with patients, that actually kind of sits oddly with the priorities of the NHS. And the other thing that I'd expect to see in a revised workforce plan, and I think Wes Streeting has already hinted at this, is that there needs to be a much greater emphasis on the idea of preventing illnesses and the idea of community care, and a lot less emphasis in the idea that every single thing that goes wrong with a person, they immediately have to see a doctor, and that is the only medical professional that will do the job, and there's no reason for any interventions otherwise. There's a lot of interesting trials of different ways of working with people, especially in a community setting and a preventative setting, that are actually going on around the UK at the moment. And I think it is interesting to see also some thinking about the training needs of these other professionals, as instead of only thinking about the need to train doctors.
I really do sympathise with particularly those any UK nationals overseas who are on those campuses abroad that are working in collaboration with UK universities. I mean, I think the expectation definitely would have been there that there would have been some form of incentivization, particularly when a lot of them would have been training off the back of the pandemic, expecting that they'd be doing something that would really be giving back. And the fact that there isn't that level of incentivization, of course, this isn't in any way preventative, but I think that's something that is really challenging, and particularly with the time and investment that this training takes. I think that's a real shame, and hopefully something that would have come out of consultation, but there doesn't seem to have been much of that in the name of talking to these students.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on Wocky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wocky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Alex, Danny, DK and Michael Salmon for making it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay Wocky.